get started, we have a slight change in our agenda. I don't see Mr. Martinson here, but do we have representatives from Volunteers of America? There's been a request to provide some information related to their conduit debt issuance, and they just wanted to provide some additional information for our consideration. This won't actually come to the council, I believe, until October 5th. But you're available, so he wanted to make sure you had an opportunity, and we're putting you first on the agenda. I think you have some obligations elsewhere.
Sure.
So do you want to go ahead?
Okay. Well, thank you. My name is Wayne Olson. I'm the Executive Vice President of Operations for Volunteers of America National Services. We've been privileged to operate the homestead of Rochester now for nearly 10 years, and on that campus we have two affordable housing buildings, High Points, and about 96 units of subsidized senior housing there. And then we've had two components in our existing building, assisted living and independent living. And then this last year, in fact this year earlier, we opened 51 more units of independent living and a 56-bed nursing home to add to our campus. We are at the point now where the demand for our services have exceeded the recent expansion that we've completed. It's a great problem to have. And we have more individuals that, quite a few more, that would like to come and live and be part of our community within Rochester and receive the services that we offer. So we're looking at a project, hopefully to break ground this fall, fall being like November as opposed to October. And this project would add more independent living units as well as some additional assisted living and memory care units. We have a strong market study for this project. It would be, the debt would be woven into the existing debt under the existing umbrella of bonds that have been sold. We would be selling, in essence, additional bonds within that. And historically, as we have done this type of a debt issuance, we have done it within denominations of $25,000 denominations. And of course, there's a kind of a choice or an option that the conduiting agency has, and that is to either set it at 25,000 denominations or $100,000 denominations. What we find for us and for those that we serve is that the lower amount allows for more local community participation. It allows for actually many people that live in our campuses that decide that they want to make an investment in the expansion of our campuses. And we're hoping that we can get support for that level of bond issuance, the $25,000 denomination and increments above that, which again talks to a broader audience. And for us, it allows us to have a better opportunity for a lower and better interest rate than if we just are basically selling to institutional investors as opposed to the community in general. So it ends up being a win-win, we think, for the communities, for those that we serve, and for the sustainability of the project into the future. So we're excited to do this additional expansion. It'll be about $30-35 million project, and it will continue to build out what was the horse farm there many, many years ago. This will pretty much use up the existing zoning capacity for this project. While we're referring to this as a phase three, there is little opportunity for a phase four. So this is likely the expansion that we'll have on the currently zoned property. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, but basically we're hoping for support for the $25,000 denomination versus the $100,000 denomination for the conduit activity for the tax-exempt bonds.
You have a question?
Well, I was just going to say, I have no issue with this whatsoever. So,
I was going to say, I see Mr. Martinson arrived. First off, was there a typo in the memo you wrote us? At one point, you say $5,000.
Right.
Oh, I must have been a typo, yeah.
Okay.
Well, there were requests in the past to go as low as 5,000. Not necessarily by this organization, but
the request in this case is 25.
And we had denied those 5,000 because we thought that got to a level where... So there's sort of this idea of the accredited investor, where when you start getting to 25,000 and you're trying to shelter income at at these levels protecting that debt, that you probably are somewhat sophisticated already, and you can actually get letters of, if you need to get letters of net worth of more than $1 million or whatever, basically make sure that you don't end up with the charter house issue where those were sold at $5,000 per unit. We had a number of mom and pops back in the day that came screaming at the city of Rochester because we had the city of Rochester name on these bonds because it gets sold at the tax unit issuance under our name. And they basically said, well, why isn't the city paying out on these? But essentially, somebody has to do enough research and advise them to understand that these are not being supported by the city's full tax faith and credit of the city of Rochester. And that's all we're trying to do by having that in our policy, was to get the level up high enough where it's either rated and people know what exactly they're, because somebody else went through and rated the whole thing, or at $100,000, you're right, you end up with the institutional investors. Basically, they're trying to find a tier that's above the, somebody who's just small, not really taking the time to read stuff and doing whatever the broker's telling them, but at some level where they probably are smart enough to know what they're getting into.
The city has no obligation to repay these bonds.
Right. So just going back to the email we got from you, is the staff support the $25,000 level?
Yes, we have on the two prior ones, too.
Okay.
But we're not comfortable with $5,000 because we think at that level, you are doing it to some people.
But that's not what they're requesting.
Right. Okay.
Oh, all right.
That's easy.
I didn't understand that either, so I appreciate the question.
I probably was writing it on the phone while I was bouncing around on the airplane.
It was crystal clear to me. Thank you.
At one point of clarity was, just to add on to what has been said, is that we do the $25,000, and then above $25,000, it's done on 25 additional $5,000 increments.
Right.
So somebody could buy $40,000 as opposed to two $25,000, but the threshold is $25,000.
You didn't know you got to do $25,000.
Right. Well, I think one of the things I've been very encouraged by what BOA has done is providing independent living and affordable housing, and you've definitely put your money where your mouth is in developing a very nice, attractive facility. So for that reason, I'm pretty supportive of providing whatever assistance we can. One thing, too, I think your staff is correct. $25,000, that's still a sufficient threshold that you're going to get an informed investor, not just someone pulling a few bucks out of out of their wallet. So that's encouraging.
I echo the sentiments. No reservations about supporting this going forward.
I just would want to make the point that this is actually coming toward a public hearing on October 5th.
Right.
This was just, they're doing a lot of groundwork and towards ahead of this time, so they're ready to put a sale. We just want to have a read from the council before we actually put all that stuff together.
Let's do that.
All right.
I won't be here on October 5th, but I'm fully supportive.
Okay. I think everyone appears to be supportive. All right. Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have a comprehensive plan update. Ms. Baker and others will lead us through this.
Mark Colfer and Brad Scheiber are here from HPGI, and they'll be presenting to you. Pass those down. These are for your item to follow along if you'd like.
Sorry.
We've made our way through a fair amount of the work necessary to actually build up some of the background data and to take into account a lot of the information that informs us where we have some of the constraints in the public infrastructure system, where we have opportunities to to have a more development, where we have some of the challenges in terms of additional infrastructure improvements that might be needed, and what some of those costs might be. We're going to be pulling some of that together in the next few weeks. Hopefully, as we report some of that back to you in early November, we should have some real detailed information for you that will help us compare two different scenarios with what we call a trends scenario, kind of projecting forward some of the growth trends that we have in the past. Our consultants will kind of cover those. But at this point, we want to touch base to tell you where we've been, what we've done, and what you're going to expect to see in the next few months.
Thanks, Missy. Good afternoon. We do want to do just that. We're probably really on the cusp of a lot of activity that's going to come forward and be far more visible. There's been an awful lot going on that I would label as more behind the scenes right now, but that will change as we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
But we thought as we're about to emerge into that kind of phase of activity, it would be appropriate to take a few minutes and give you an update as to where we are and give you specifically some specifics about what's upcoming, both in terms of activities, tasks, and time. So I want to start by just for the sake of the room, really bringing us all back to the same page kind of what we're doing. Just as a quick reminder, the comprehensive plan effort has been branded as P2S Planning to Succeed. That's a brand that's actually been very public for a couple of years. And it is an effort to update the city's long-range comprehensive plan. That plan, is, as you know, guides future growth, development in the city of Rochester. It focuses really on land use, development, transportation, and public utilities, perhaps foremostly, but includes other things, and those other things I'll touch on briefly as well. The one thing that we have to remind ourselves of periodically, and I think it's important for the community to know, is the city didn't just step back a year or so ago and say, let's update our comprehensive plan, or let's create a comprehensive plan more accurately. This really is part of a pattern of a great deal of planning that this community has done over a long period of time. There have been prior versions of the comprehensive plan and various land use transportation updates. If you recall, a few years ago, the downtown master plan occurred. There's been bike planning that's been done. There's energy planning that's ongoing. DMC, I probably don't have to remind you too much that that was a big planning initiative that recently, I won't say came to fruition, but reached a milestone presentation and now is moving into subsequent phases. And so this is another piece in that rich history, if you will, of Rochester's planning and looking at where it needs to be 10 and 20 years in the future. We are pulling information, obviously, from a variety of resources. We've talked before in this group about the broad consulting team that Brad and I represent in terms of expertise in engineering and transportation and a variety of other disciplines. But clearly also the folks that you have appointed to various boards and commissions weighing in on this and the council itself are important parts of this. We also have been seeking throughout this process, and I think I can use the word genuinely from the beginning, input from the community in a variety of ways. That will continue. That's been ongoing, and that will certainly continue as well. Somewhere down the line, we get to tie a bow around all of this and say, here we are, we're kind of at the end of the journey, and then obviously it comes back ultimately to this body for approval and adoption and going forward from that point. I indicated a moment ago, we're very active, I should say, with DMC and all the planning efforts that were going on there. There was efficiency that was built into this process by utilizing some of the same engineering and transportation consultants on both teams. You've seen the same faces show up, whether it was a comp plan meeting or a DMC meeting. We also, at one point in time, actually probably slowed down the comp plan schedule a little bit to make sure we were synchronizing with the schedule at DMC. It didn't compromise anything in the end, but it certainly was efficient in the way that the two projects were coming together. So let me serve up the reminder of just what's in the comprehensive plan. You can pick up a comprehensive plan for a variety of communities, and they'll all look and feel a little bit different, candidly. At least if they're done well, they'll look a little differently, because they really are tailored to the needs of that specific community. There certainly are some kind of standard fundamentals that are there. There are some statutory things that are there, but really how you rearrange the elements in a comprehensive plan, what you emphasize, there's a certain amount of discretion that locally comes to play. And that certainly has happened here. Rochester has had a history, and I think a current time, of really emphasizing some things that most communities are really doing now as well. Maybe it's a catch-up, but that land use and transportation are so closely tied together. You know, 20 years ago, we would have done the land use chapter of the comp plan, then we would have moved on to the transportation chapter. Those are really very tightly linked in today's world. And not distant third whatsoever, but somewhat parcel to that utility component as well, because the infrastructure of which transportation sometimes is considered one is a key piece of how the city will grow. This plan, and I may have made this statement before in this group, and if I didn't, I'll underscore it. This plan is pretty unique because we're looking at fiscal impacts. And I would guarantee you that if you pick up comprehensive plans for 100 communities, you'd find very few that even look at the fiscal side of things. There would be some language at the end of it that would talk about implementation and might talk broadly about funding programs. But in this particular case, Springstead is a component of our team. As the city's financial advisors have a great deal of history and resources there. And we're actually doing compatible computer modeling with the fiscal implications of what's happening on the physical side. And as I said, that's something you do not find in very many venues. I don't want to emphasize or de-emphasize these too much, but parks and recreation, open space, housing, economic development, public facilities are part of this plan as well. They're kind of linked back to the big three, if you will, of land use, transportation, utilities, and fiscal being part of the big three, four. Parks and recreation, I should make note of, is in the process of updating the city's parks and recreation master plan. That's a separate effort from this. That's a compatible effort to this, and what you'll see in the comprehensive plan is the parks piece will be more policy and general guideline with specifics come into play with the work that's being done on the park side right now. So, you know, again, this I would emphasize strongly, this is a plan that's really geared in its components and its content to the city of Rochester, not a model that's been adopted and falls in everywhere that you look. So why do you do a plan? A variety of reasons. There's kind of the philosophical reasons, but there's practical reasons too. It certainly brings value to the city in a variety of ways. This is a group I don't have to talk about how the pressure you get about the, kind of how you allocate public resources, whether those are financial or whether those are programmatic or manpower kinds of things. A comprehensive plan helps do that because you're setting priorities for the way you want the city to grow in the next 10 to 20 years. We're basically targeting 2040 as we talk about the comp plan. So all of the efforts that we're looking at and working towards are focused on that date. And, you know, our crystal ball typically is pretty good for 5 years, maybe 10 years, 20 years. It starts to get a little more murky, candidly. But that just goes with the specifics of the comp plan. The implementation piece will very much hone in on what happens in the first 5 and 10 year period of time, and then beyond that to 2040, beginning to talk more broadly about the kinds of things that occur. Most comprehensive plans and the plans that have been done in Rochester before certainly seek to have a certain amount of flexibility to them. Any plan that's adopted will certainly usually be challenged with a new idea at some point in time, whether that's hopefully not the day after it's adopted, but it's a year after, whatever it might be. Typically, plans are updated and they're modified as time goes forward. They are very much living documents. They're not static in the way they sit. So let me tell you what we've been doing a bit behind the scenes, and then Brad in a moment will get into a little bit more detail about some of what that is. As I indicated, we've kind of got the three-legged stool in terms of the process. The modeling components looking at land use, transportation, and fiscal. Our partners, Sasaki and Associates and Springstead, have the brain power, the computer power, the expertise behind the modeling. A lot of that has been going on and going forward. Springstead has actively been meeting with the department heads to make sure that some of the inputs are accurate, and you'll see the fruits of some of those labors on the fiscal side within the next roughly 30 days. So that's been ongoing, and that's a big piece of this. Where we are in terms of overall time, there's always a "we are here" on every slide. And this just absorbs the point of it. We are where it says we are here in red. We have been working on and continue to work on really the alternative scenarios. And again, bear with us for a minute because Brad will remind you kind of what those are. We've had a lot of activities to date. We are coming up to a very key period with public engagement in early November. We will actually have several different kind of views of what could happen for people to look at and weigh in on. That will be an intense time. We're gearing up for that now, and we'll ultimately talk about that, I'm sure, in other sessions. We're looking at, by the first quarter of 2016, having the draft plan finished, and I'll come back at the end of my remarks and talk a little bit about what that is, such that then there will be more guests estimating, based on typical practice, about a three-month review time period, getting back to all of the community, the boards and commissions, ultimately bringing it back before the council for adoption roughly at that point in time. We started with some things happening this year. These aren't quite chronological. Looking at in May, we had some extensive background and analysis work that was done that really was helping position us to better understand the inputs that we were going to have for these alternative scenarios that are underway now. We started that modeling process in March. It literally has been ongoing since that period of time with a variety of iterations. We are looking at the present time, as I indicated, being actively involved in some of this modeling, but again, the product of which you will see in the very near term. And I think since we were here last time, and we have a couple of members in the room, I believe, the city has actually formed the Community Advisory Committee, a lovely acronym being CAC, if you will, that we use, That group has been diligent in a couple of meetings in helping us set the stage for the foundation of some vision aspects of the community that will be coming back to you shortly for review also. And that's something that we think is going to tie in very closely to these alternative scenarios that we've been working on, because they might impart a different way in which the city begins to interpret its future, and we'll be able to articulate what some of that is as we go forward. I mentioned before that throughout this process, and as it continues, community engagement will still be something we will emphasize and be a significant component of this. We've had lots of touch points from the community in a variety of ways, and I'm going to go through the things that we've done, specifically that are identified there. We've talked about some of those in this venue before, such as CrowdGauge. The group that's seated at the bottom there, that really good-looking group of people, that's the community advisory committee. Again, maybe if you don't mind, raise your hand if you're on it so that space we've got. Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
So those folks have been very helpful in really beginning to set the stage, and we pledge to them that they'll have an active schedule of meetings upcoming, and they will have just that. And so that's a great group for us to work with on kind of helping steer this overall process. So I mentioned in my remarks a couple of times what we're doing now and really what we've been doing for a number of months now with scenario development. And I think, Brad, we'd like to give you a little bit more of a drill down as to what that is, to give you a better feel of what to anticipate as we move forward here and literally in the weeks ahead.
Well, I will dive into some of the technical aspects of this and talk, keeping it at a high level. As Sasaki and Associates is the one that actually developed the model, and the gentleman that does all the model work always reminds me, the reason I do this is because I have a PhD plus a bunch of other education. So I'm going to try not to get too technical on you, but give you a little high-level overview of the scenario development process and what we've been working on. A couple things just to emphasize. This is part of the planning process. And so what we're talking about in scenarios here, the scenarios aren't the plan itself. They're just a means to be able to evaluate kind of what-if scenarios. What if we went this direction? What if we went through that direction? And to be able to compare those across the different platforms to be able to guide us towards what is the best plan that we can craft for Rochester. We've done a number of different things, as Mark's kind of alluded to. The first thing that we did was understanding that existing conditions, what's there today that we're working with. We've gone through a process in talking about the first scenario, which is the trend scenario. If we just kept doing what has been happening over the last couple decades, what might that future look like? And through that computer modeling process, we projected those land uses, and then we spent a number of days talking through that with different stakeholder groups in the city of Rochester back in May, in spring of 2015. Using that information, we've then begun to work through various staff-level meetings, processes to develop a couple different scenarios. And that's what we'll talk about here. Once we go through that evaluation of all these different what-if possibilities, then we get into that preferred plan, and as Mark mentioned, we're kind of on the cusp of getting to that point and then diving into that preferred plan process. So there are a number of different inputs that go into these scenarios. Land use is the big one that we're working on. And land use, that land use input talks about how much growth goes where and in what form and what means. That then informs the other modeling processes, whether it be transportation, infrastructure, or financial. We look at things like current zoning. We look at things like infrastructure. Where is it at and what kind of capacity is there to accommodate future growth? We have an understanding of what current development plans are and what people are thinking about or prospecting on in the community. We want to make sure that any scenario we look at respects some of the market trends and some of the directions that the marketplace is going. We also make sure we understand the environmental conditions and what are some of the constraints that we want to accommodate, and what are the open space networks that people talk very highly of in the community wanting to preserve and protect. The last one there is projections. Those projections get into population and housing. What is that actual demand that drives growth in the community? And so one of the key things that we've done is across all of the scenarios that we're testing, we're keeping the projections constant. So those numbers, you've seen those presented throughout the course of the project. The new residents that we plan to bring over the next, over the duration of the plan project, how many jobs there will be over that duration, and how many housing units are needed to accommodate that population growth. We've kept those projections constant across the trend scenario and the two alternatives that we're developing.
And Brad, I'll just interject there for a moment. When you look at these numbers and projections and you think through how that translates into land demand, we actually take studied data, trends. It's very data-driven. It's a lot of numbers and taking a look at how that impacts the demand for square footage of different kinds of uses. What's the square footage demand for industrial manufacturing? What's the square footage demand for commercial and retail and for business? That translates into land demand that would be associated with those kind of land uses as well. So when we look forward, as we go through this journey of developing a plan, I just want you to understand it's very much based in a lot of data that helps us understand what the true anticipated projections would be, what we really reasonably could anticipate for growth in this community.
One footnote, 50,000 new residents is what we grew from 1980 to 2010. So it's basically almost the same.
Slower percentage wise.
Yeah. Smaller base.
So taking that growth, and this is where some of what Mitzi talked about, building in a bunch of assumptions about land demand. And what Mitzi was referring to was a very comprehensive approach at looking at all the parcel data in the city of Rochester and understanding what kind of densities we're seeing out there today, but also understanding, and when I say densities, both residential but also retail and office, and how intense is that land being used. But we're also looking at local, regional, and national data sources and looking at what is the development community doing differently. Do we expect those particular densities and intensity ratios to simply go forward as they are today, or might they change a little bit? And so the transportation, ROCOG has done a lot of work on this avenue, so we use some of that information. We've tapped into regional and national real estate development groups like Urban Land Institute, who's been down here in Rochester. And we've used that information to help populate some of that. So this is what we presented back in May, and I think you may have seen this already, but basically this is saying in that trend scenario, if we project that growth forward, what will we continue to see happen from a growth standpoint? And you can see the yellow are the residential areas, the red are the commercial areas. The red typically follows those key transportation corridors or locations where there's existing presence. You see growth from a residential standpoint continue to move in the northwest or northeasterly direction, northerly direction, and a little bit in other areas where there's already existing development plans or proposals. So we're continuing to see that growth occur similar to what has happened in the last 10 to 15 years. We also see similar transit demand and service growth following that same pattern. So transit and transportation systems, park and recreation systems, we looked at all of those different components and said, if we continue this trend, how do those factor in? So we took that information out and we presented it in those meetings back in May to different stakeholder groups, including general populace as well as specific focus groups and the development and architecture and real estate community. And we asked them questions that would help us inform what alternatives we might look at. And some of the things we got back, people talked about improving and expanding transit service, it's both more frequency but also longer duration during the day. Enhancing the bike and pedestrian environment, ensuring access to amenities throughout the city, and both vehicular access as well as pedestrian and bike access. Utilizing existing infrastructure systems that's going to support that new growth. And a lot of talk about how do we utilize what we have today in the most efficient way. Exploring targeted infill and redevelopment, and that's, again, getting at that sustainability and efficiency of land use. Where we've got skipped over land, how do we make sure we have the systems in place to support that growth? And in that vein, people talked about key transportation corridors and prominent nodes along those transit corridors and transportation corridors. And those two points, I think, really led us down a path of some key things with the alternatives that we look at. There was a fair amount of talk about edge growth. Is it good or is it not good? And I think for the balance that we heard as we heard people talk about it, we need to accommodate that market demand. People are still going to want to have single-family residential neighborhoods, and so there's a balance between how much growth happens on the edge and how much growth we try to support more on the infill and redevelopment aspects.
So with those, we've worked with staff and we've come up with two different alternatives that we want to use in this testing, you know, two different what-ifs. And again, I just want to remind people, these aren't the plan. These are simply directions that we can begin to explore, and we can run through that modeling process and be able to compare trend scenario, alternative one, alternative two. So the general gist of alternative one, we call it filling in the city. And on this one, we made a key assumption. And we said all the growth that's going to happen over the duration of this plan is going to happen within current city limits. So the trend scenario said we're going to let things go as they've gone, and we'll see growth outside of the boundaries. This scenario says let's see what happens if we just keep it in. We also said let's look at key nodes and corridors. And so the green lines represent key transportation corridors. Those corridors would emphasize transportation systems, all modes. Transit, a greater frequency and intensity of transit services, vehicle access, bike, pedestrian systems. So if you think about just enhancing those street corridors, that enhancement would attract a certain amount of development. The red dots represent key nodes. Those nodes, again, we're going to look at intensifying those nodes, and where there's possibility for growth within those nodes, we would look to locate more of the growth, more of that demand that we're keeping constant, into those key nodes. That might mean a little higher density in those key nodes, a little different development form. We also said in both scenarios, we looked at the DMC's plan. So in the first scenario, in the trend scenario, we're using downtown master plan. These scenarios use the DMC's master plan. The only difference between the two with DMC is level of intensity. The DMC plan talks about a range of growth in housing, a range of growth in commercial and office. So in one scenario, we said let's use the lower end. On the other scenario, we said let's use the higher end of that growth. Surrounding downtown are a series of residential neighborhoods where you've been seeing already infill and redevelopment happen surrounding the downtown. And so we said, let's look at these neighborhoods, and we ran a fair amount of analysis to look at where those opportunities might exist. We said these neighborhoods, these core neighborhoods, might absorb some additional housing demand within those areas. So again, no growth outside of existing city boundaries, and intensifying or directing more of that growth towards those key transportation corridors and those key nodes. Higher transit demand service on those key nodes is another key factor of this. So we talked about a primary transit network and using those corridors as an emphasis for that greater frequency and longer duration. You want to add anything?
The only thing I can add to that would be where you see nodes, the key to that is in order to have increased service and frequency, an increased time of service for transit, you really have to have higher levels of demand. And if you don't have those anchored at different nodes, it's very difficult to pay for a system without just simply increasing subsidy. So you're looking at a certain amount of fare box return on your transit system. And we're trying to demonstrate that there might be alternatives for you to take a look at how to make the transit system more robust, but tie that land use to it so it works.
How do we make that transit system more sustainable? And I think that's relevant in all the concepts that we look at. So then we look at a second alternative. And so this alternative kind of bridges both the trend scenario and alternative one. Here, rather than having multiple nodes, we only have two nodes. We often call them the super nodes. They're really big nodes. They're regional centers. So you have your downtown already. We might have one to the south, and we might have one to the north. And then the green line represents an enhanced transportation corridor, which again is transportation, bike, walk, and vehicle access. But that's that key corridor connecting those key nodes. In this scenario, we also assume, though, that we aren't going to constrain growth entirely within the city limits. We might have a little bit of that growth span beyond, but not as much as the trend scenario, because we're looking at intensifying those super nodes a little more and directing more growth into those nodes. So on this particular one, you still have your DMC, but in this particular case, the growth is not as intensive as the alternative scenario one. It's the lower range of the DMC's planning study. I may have those flip-flopped. We still have the core neighborhoods, again, a similar scenario as we had in the first scenario. So we do have some in this particular one we would anticipate. Some growth will be allocated outside of the city limits based on the modeling process. So trend scenario, alternative one, and alternative two, looking at those nodes and corridors and how we handle growth on the edge.
So what do we do after we run these models and it puts out these alternative scenarios? We then build what we're calling land use and development indicators, among other indicators. And these are going to be the factors that we look at across the three scenarios to say, what does it mean? What does it do from a land use distribution standpoint? What does it mean from a land cover or a hard surface cover if we look at this different development pattern? And we build all these assumptions into it and begin to compare them across each other. The land use, residential land uses in these different growth areas, what does it mean from population density and housing diversity and the ability to achieve greater levels of diversity? What does it mean from non-residential land use? Again, looking at those growth areas, the level of intensity of retail or office uses, does it change the form? Does it all of a sudden go vertical, one story versus two story, and what implication does that have? Same with the number of jobs per square foot or per acre of these nodes. We look at parkland per capita based on the two and a distribution of parkland. If we have a smaller development footprint, what does that mean from a parkland usage standpoint? We also then provide the land use data to transportation planners. Nelson Nygaard is on our team. They're going to take this information working with SRF, and they're going to plug all of this land use data into roadway network planning and figuring out what does this do to our arterial and collector street system, how does it affect connectivity, what does it mean from a greenhouse gas emission standpoint, looking at the different development pattern and how roadways handle it, how does transit respond to the alternative scenarios based on the proximity or the propensity for transit usage. As well as this idea of supporting a 20-minute neighborhood. How does downtown access mode share factor in? What does the pedestrian and bicycle network, how does it respond to the different alternative scenarios and what opportunities for more active living do the different scenarios present based on those land uses, et cetera? This is just an example of where we talked about the downtown access mode share. If you remember out of the downtown master plan, we had this mode share goal. And when we projected those forward, Nelson Nygaard made a projection and said, basically, if we kept that trend scenario and we move forward, this is what we can expect to see coming out of it in a rough projection. So we'll do a similar projection when we look at the two alternatives and be able to compare those. And as Mark mentioned, the other thing that we're doing that many comprehensive plans fall short of doing is getting into the fiscal impact. And what does this mean from a financial standpoint? Transportation is a big part of that. The capital costs, the physical improvements that need to happen, new roads, transit investments, sidewalk trails, etc. But also the life cycle costs, the ongoing operating costs of those infrastructure systems, and the replacement costs over time. The non-transportation infrastructure is out there as well. Your potable water systems, your sanitary sewer, your stormwater systems, your general government services. And both, again, your capital costs and your assets, as well as your life cycle costs. And what is the economic value creation? One of the things we heard a lot in the public input, when people commented on the pros and cons, both ways, of expanding growth on the edge versus infill versus redevelopment, you know, everybody talked about expanding the tax base and that economic value and that economic engine. And so based on these different development alternatives and the different growth patterns we talked about, applying some assumptions, what economic value creation differences might these different alternatives have. So, that in a nutshell, the non-technical overview of the alternatives.
Let me tell you quickly what's next, and then we'll stop talking and get back to some discussion here. As you've seen, we've availed ourselves of every advantage we get to come before the committee of the whole and provide these kinds of updates, and that will continue as we go forward, as will some more substantive kind of feedback I would assume that we would get at some of these sessions as well. We're aware that there is, and I think it's early November, there is a joint council and county board meeting coming up, and the comprehensive plan will be a subject of discussion of that, and we'll be supporting that discussion with the materials that's coming together. I mentioned early on in my remarks that really we have a lot of stuff that's about to bubble up to the surface, if you will, and that really is personified by the activities that are going to be occurring in early November. The organization, the site of that, which is now maybe 10% complete, obviously work to do there. But that really is the option, or the time rather, that we'll be able to come forward with demonstration of what all of this scenario stuff means, if I can put it in that context. graphics, text, charts, numbers about what all of this means and what options there are coming out of this. And again, those are not three specific versions of a plan for Rochester, but rather three ways in which Rochester might develop in the future, of which then we get to kind of throw those in the pot and stir them up and see what really comes out as being in the best interest of this community. And the valuation that the community will be doing in November will help us get to that point. When we get to this winter, a little later, and into the early part of the winter when we cross the new year, we're going to be coming back to you with specific plan content. And don't worry, we're not going to come forward with a 4-inch document, throw it on the table, or throw it into your email basket on Friday night and say we'd like some feedback by Monday. We're going to be more diligent in measuring that out in doses that are manageable, so kind of a chapter-by-chapter review we'll be able to go through. I want to emphasize there's connectivity between a lot of these components of the plan, land use, transportation, and others, that will make sure that we weave together as we approach it in more of that piecemeal fashion. The intent is that we certainly will have a draft plan for public review, as I said, at the end of the first quarter, a roughly 3-month period of time going forward after that, for all of the back and forth, the review, the modifications, the edits, and to come forward with a plan that's really ready for adoption in the second quarter of 2016. In closing, I would just say that Mitzi used a term a minute ago that I want to pick up on. And that comment was that she made was that this is data-driven. This probably is going to be the most data-driven, data-intense comprehensive plan that I personally have been involved in, and I hate to confess, but more than 3 decades of comprehensive planning. That's really a great thing. We're not slaves to the data, if you will, but we're going to have so much information coming out of this to illustrate what ideas mean in terms of directions that they could go. We really can have a very frank dialogue and assessment of how that translates into the real world. We've talked a lot about fiscal model. The fiscal model, like the comprehensive plan, is at a fairly high level, so I don't want anybody to walk out of here thinking, I'm going to know exactly that if we do this, this, and this, that it's going to increase my tax bill or decrease my tax bill by X. That's a level of specificity that is not covered in comprehensive plan or modeling. But we will get some really good insights from a fiscal perspective and the big picture of things and what it costs the city to do business in the future under different scenarios. And that's a pretty exciting thing. So one of our goals in all of this, and I probably shouldn't state this because somebody will remind me of this, was that this will be an award-winning plan at the end of the day. It's just very unique in the way this is coming together. As I said, you've got components that are being pulled together with this that traditionally are not part of this process. So with that, hopefully we've rambled on long enough to give you a feel for what's going on. And I would love to ask you to see if she wants to offer anything, but otherwise we'll be able to questions or comments that you have.
All right. Mitzi, any additional comments at this point?
No, I support the idea of an award-winning plan. I really think this is being set up as something that could be a model for many communities across the country.
I'll open it up to the council. Questions, comments?
Maybe this is too far ahead, but do either of those scenarios require us going into those Northwest territories? They do the set. Both are.
So for folks in the audience who don't know what the reference is, there's an area of the city that has been projected for future growth. And to serve the area with sanitary sewer takes an extraordinary investment. Mm-hmm. We're looking at other areas where the city could grow and what the trade-offs might be between investing in that here versus there and some of that cost benefit for the return. It may turn out that that's the most financially prudent place to put those facilities, or it may turn out that there are other places that can accommodate the growth that would actually avoid some of those expenditures.
Anyone else? Mr. Hickey.
I am. Sorry. Okay.
So when I look at alternate two, I mean, is this a serious proposal? I mean, it kind of looks like a throwaway. And how realistic is it that we're not really going to expand, do limited expansion outside the existing city boundaries? We're going to target redevelopment of infill and core neighborhoods?
Mm-hmm. we wouldn't label it as a throwaway by any means. It's different than the other two by far, which is a good thing. We hail from Twin Cities. I'm down here frequently sometimes on some personal matters. I drive past IBM all the time. There's a huge resource there that something has to happen there. And I think one of the key aspects of this option is to say, we got a big resource there. What do we do with it? Can that be employment? Can that be housing? Can that be open space? And I think that's one of the things that this particular option looks at with more seriousness, if you will. So I don't think in that regard it's at all a throwaway, but it's valuable as an opposing opinion. And we'll, again, have data and numbers that will come out of this that will show, if you put jobs there, what's the impact on transportation? What's the impact on infrastructure? So I would label it, I guess, in that manner. It's a good point.
Part of the exercise is to actually lay out two alternatives that prompt some different thinking about, a real what if. We have to create enough of maybe a separation between this scenario and that scenario to actually see much in terms of differences. It'll help us understand what some of the potential impacts are. And as we get to November and pass that, we'll be able to better shape
the outcomes that the city most desires after looking at
real information.
We don't know what that
final
will
look
like yet.
Right.
So we'll
help us
get
there. Right.
Thank you.
Ms. Means? This is such a big project. I'm just wondering where to start. Thank you. Planning to succeed is commendable. It looks like you're doing just a tremendous job of data collection. I was kind of surprised to see that the growth on page 12, where it says example downtown access model in 2030, the trend is still driving alone at 64%. Am I understanding that correctly? I would expect, 15 years or so that driving alone would start trending downward, especially with that improvement in our bikes, transportation, mobility, transportation other than automobile. I thought it was kind of high, but don't ask me about numbers. But
what you're seeing is a demonstration that if all we do really is look at different land use and transportation patterns outside the downtown, under the trend scenario with that type of pattern, it's not going to do enough to help us to achieve our motion goals. That we need to make a more concerted effort to help meet those goals. The other thing that's happening, and you're all aware, the city has recently hired a program management consultant to help us with the next steps of studies and implementation of the DMC plan. And part of that is looking at how to help move this more shift so that we can achieve higher intensity of development in the downtown but still accommodate getting people in and out of downtown to jobs and get customers.
The other a question, I know you're doing a lot of scenario explorations. For example, things have been happening so quickly, like with frac sanding, it was just booming. I mean, there was enough houses and, people were sharing little cottages and et cetera. And now that boom is not busted, but it's down, pointing downward. Who would ever have thought 1 year later that this would have gone down? Or gas. Did you think it? Or gas. I mean, I'm still going to get up there to North Dakota one day and see that frac sign. And
I'll show you around.
You'll show me. The other thing is with the gas. I mean, it's just, that it's all data-driven, all of your inputs, data-driven inputs. But how do you factor in those more flexible kinds of trends that may not be evident at this moment, but in the future?
If we were a group of North Dakota folks sitting around this room 10 years ago, we wouldn't have had any idea, truthfully. I mean, somebody might have had some thoughts that something would happen, but I don't think to the degree of magnitude that occurred. The fortunate thing we have sitting here in Rochester, in lieu of Minot or pick another city, is that Rochester has had, as Gary was alluding to, a growth pattern that's been pretty consistent from 1980, 30 years hence, and now 30 years in the future. Yes, the percentage dips around a little bit, but the numbers are fairly constant. And I think that goes to kind of the core of this community and the core of its economic engines, obviously the big one being healthcare, but it's been technology and data before, and there's always entrepreneurs that look at those kind of things. So I think the plan certainly will accommodate a range of growth and a range of the ways this could happen. I think that's another argument for, a great argument for looking at different scenarios and different densities, because at the end of the day, I don't think any planning effort, whether it's comp plan or corporate things or anything you might be involved in, if you say we've got options A, B, and C, usually everybody doesn't line up under one of those. It begins to be a hybrid and a synthesis out of that, and I suspect that's what will happen here. And I think we'll be able to, in looking at those differences, be able to build some flexibility and to accommodate some maybe more rapid growth in the future, or possibly even some growth that plateaus a little bit more. But certainly not having to take into account or try to take into account the oil kinds of things that's been going on in the roads. Those from a planning and community context, it's probably good news, depending on your perspective, but very few and far between.
I know your focus is right here in the city, but those were just two examples.
No,
I thought.
Good ones.
Oh, my.
There's been a lot of jaw-dropping things going on from a planning, engineering, and design perspective, with all of that rush for oil.
Well, two other questions, if I may ask. And I don't know where I saw this, but the vision is coming.
Yes.
After? I mean, I think about vision, it's something that you start with.
Yep,
And so, okay. It looked like that was not integral at this point.
We started with that, and through the work the CAC has done, we've kind of advanced that to a certain point. And one of the things that we like about bringing the vision discussion and some of these alternatives together is there's an illustration for people to say, well, I think the city should be this. Well, if you really think that, here's a glimpse of what it might look like. And so we've taken the approach of kind of combining a little of those, but the vision is underway. In fact, we'll come back and be able to report some of that information to you in the near term. But I don't want you to think that at all that's been set aside and we're going to focus on what we're going to do and then we're going to make the vision match it. I think rather we're taking an approach to say that we can illustrate what some of these ideas mean in a more tangible way than sometimes just thinking back in a room and, well, we'd like to do this. How realistic is that? We can answer that.
My last question, Mr. President.
What?
I'll give somebody else a chance, but it is beginning to bother me more and more that there is less and less representation of different ethnic groups. And I know how difficult it has been in my prior life. It was hard. It's hard. But I think it's important, especially since our school district continues to grow and the many, many different languages that are spoken, that we hear those voices. Because the dominant culture can't always plan everything for everybody. So what strategy are you using to try to collect those voices, even with the community meetings that are coming up?
We have, again, probably it's a little bit less visible than some other things, but we actually, in the early stages of this planning process, have documented quite a database working with the Diversity Council and others of partners that have been at the table for some of these events in the past. We've continued to develop that and to expand that, and we're going to be going back to that as one of our primary tools of identifying how we're going to do the outreach in November. What participation we can get, I'm not sure, but I can certainly tell you quite candidly today at this table that we're going to make every effort to do just what you alluded to. And we've got some pretty good resources and contacts built in place to do that with.
Well, I trust our director, Ms. Baker, that she is incorporating that. But I just think it needs to be said over and over again. When we have advisory groups and we never see anyone that has a disability or anyone that has more melanin than others or speaks another language, you begin to say, how are we actually being inclusive? And I certainly don't have the answer, even after all of these years. I certainly don't have an answer, but somehow I think as a community, we need to represent all the community. So thank you for those comments. That's all I have to say, Mr. President.
Mr. Campion?
Yeah, could we go to the slide where you kind of have the alternatives with the nodes on them? I'll just go with the regular notes.
Sorry,
keep my notes regular. Like the copy, right?
Getting there.
So the question I have is one that stems back to our experience with the DMC plan, and it's a question of viability. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, as we talk about the placement of nodes, what level of viability examination are we doing? Because I, you know, I heard some idea about, you know, IBM is this great opportunity, and IBM's also a current employer in the community, and I don't know if they'd like being called an opportunity. You know, they do work today. So what are we doing to evaluate the placement of these nodes? How are you deciding where they go? Is it solely based off of this would be a great transit location? Is it the actual availability of the area for redevelopment? How does that work?
Yes and yes and yes and a bunch of other things.
Okay.
We did a rather, I would say, pretty exhaustive look at different locations for nodes, and we started out with a lot more than this. In the modeling process, we said if each node could accommodate this much growth, we want to make sure that we had enough growth to go throughout the rest of the community and not put it all into the individual nodes. And so we began a process to go through these different locations and said, you know, which one of these are least likely, which one of these are more likely based on land availability, based on existing uses that are in that node that could create some kind of concentration or critical mass, based on redevelopment potential. And redevelopment potential has a whole litany of different things that go into it in terms of valuation and ownership and quality of what's there. And those things all, in addition to the idea of transit spacing and proximity and location along current key arterial streets that could accommodate that mobility system. So there was a whole bunch of things that went into it. And we did do a fair amount of what we call sub-modeling to make sure that we could accommodate that amount of growth in those nodes and still be able to distribute it.
Do you think there's value falling on that? You know, if we've done the investigative part, is there something with putting together a portfolio of these redevelopable areas as a pitch to get that redevelopment kickstarted? Because that's part of what I see being a little bit of a problem is segueing from a plan to let's move forward in this way. And, you know, when I talk about viability, I think land acquisition and redevelop is important, but there's also viability in terms of what are the tools in our toolbox for encouraging this sort of development in a direction that we hope would be positive for the city. I'm, you know, kind of looking for output. Is this plan going to produce some guidance in that way, or is it still kind of put out this plan and let the development community kind of figure out for themselves where to go?
I'll just say that we first have to know the appetite for what this future plan is. If in the end, the majority of folks who are making the decision say, we want to go with the trends of what, we may not need very many neutrals.
Sure.
But if there is some intentionality around providing higher levels of service and with our transit system, increasing the hours of operation and having nodes of land use that help support that, then I think that we'll have a conversation about some of the tools for implementation that could be exciting new opportunities for us.
I guess the final question that won't take up too much more time is I saw fiscal impact in a bunch of different kind of costs and economic value creation. Man, that's a great term. That seems incredibly vague to me. But one of the things that I've been kind of encouraging and trying to look at is using property tax capacity of a parcel as an evaluative kind of process. Is that, I mean, part of the umbrella you're going to call economic value creation?
Yeah, I believe the Springstead model is a parcel-based
okay.
model. And so we're marrying, getting into a geekdom here.
I'll try not to
we're
take
marrying
it too far.
The individual tax parcel, the land use output is raster-based, so it's individual. Mm-hmm. So we start to look at, we have to translate that to the parcel-based data so we can do, as Spring said, that economic value at a parcel level.
Okay. And you also take the ramifications of having higher order development as well as a community, or is it solely it's solely parcel-based is kind of what I'm hearing?
Well, it rolls up.
Okay.
But it starts at that parcel level, but then it rolls up.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Boudreau.
Is there some thought in the slide in terms of how these are showed? Are these really the corridors that we're looking at, or is that something that we're still studying? I mean, for example, Marion Road would be one that would strike me as being a possible, you know, redevelopment corridor.
They're not fixed. Again, these are examples for us use in shaping the plan. But when we think about places where we might have higher capacity transit and redevelopment potential, you also have, you have to marry the two of those pieces mm-hmm. together. And also doing that, take a look at true land demand for residential, commercial, retail mm-hmm. and stuff. And you have to distribute that to a limited number of nodes to get them to work. So we went through an exercise in which we identified more corridors and nodes than this. And getting some humor here, because there was a lot of conversation around how do you take what looks like real potential and narrow that down and prioritize that around where the true potential is and taking into account the, what we really truly can anticipate for development and not distributing it in so much that we end up without any nodes.
I mean, obviously, you got the main ones. The obvious ones are certainly on here, you know, in terms of North and South Broadway, 2nd Street, 4th. How about the integration with Wink? How's that going?
Integration? Oh, the energy efficiency. So once we produce stuff here, that data translation happens for them, too, to run their environmental stuff now. So we're in collaboration.
And I guess my last question, this comes back to the demand. When you look at our current trends, we have a lot of demand that is probably in part due to where our fees are set. You know, for example, and what Dale's been getting me data on the just the sewer hookup charge. And we're charging, we'd have to more than triple it to actually cover our costs. And if we more than tripled that fee, the demand for single-family residential would probably go down quite a bit. I mean, how are we anticipating what that demand is really going to be in the future, assuming we don't continue to subsidize some of these money losers forever?
There's a high-level look at the different service areas, the costs for providing service to, and mm-hmm. then that translates back to the potential costs that could be for access charges.
Okay.
And that's taken that will be taken into account.
Yeah, it actually is a probability in the model about level of cost to serve different areas by sewer district and infrastructure pieces. But it doesn't answer the question about single-family detached housing demand versus other forms, but it does give a little insight into the geographic location. Of it. So it's less probability where it's higher.
All right. Anyone else?
Yes, sir. President, if I may. One quick footnote, my comment on IBM, I use the word opportunity consciously, and because nothing in this plan is going to say that the IBM operation in and of itself should change. What we look at is the amount of building square footage there that we understand is a bit echoey right now. And they've got at least 100, and I think it's roughly 160 acres of property adjacent to that. So there's some potential long-term for some intensification and change. And so opportunity is meant in that context alone. It certainly is not meant as a predictor that IBM will no longer be at Rochester and you're going to lose that architectural gem that sits there today.
All right. Anyone else? Well, one thing I do appreciate is the very deliberative data approach that we're using. I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunity for insertion of opinions along the way, but I think this gives you a good basis from which to have those discussions. So for that, I'm very appreciative and look forward to the feedback that we receive in the latter part of this year.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Well, thank you for sharing, and we look forward to some future updates.
I'd like to speak for a couple minutes.
We're at other business? So
oh, we're at other business. Okay. I want to just see if the council would agree with me on this. As many of you know, perhaps all of you know, that there's one constituent in Ward 6 that has been working on an issue for over a year. And I know that our city clerk, Mr. Reese, and many of you have had conversations with this individual. And the last I heard is he was seeking an ordinance. And I did make an inquiry just to see what we could do to what happened was the Social Security number was given to more than just the finance department. So his concern, or maybe this would be one way to look at it, is perhaps have all the Social Security numbers only housed with the finance department. Am I saying that correctly?
I'm not familiar with the situation.
I guess I've seen some notes on it. I thought that there was a proposed ordinance coming forward with that or something.
No.
You don't need an ordinance.
Yeah, there's no ordinance that was needed, but yes, and also to educate the staff when a Tennyson warning is required by the state law. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, real. I don't think he's paranoid about data privacy. I think he's wanting to make sure that we're adhering to the data privacy by having it only go to one department rather than, you know, maybe to Public Works and then maybe to the city clerk and maybe to planning and zoning. I'm not sure where all that information is stored. But it does bring a question about should we be more prudent in ensuring that the folks that we ask for that information, that it's definitely needed and that it goes to one location. So, yes, ma'am.
I will say that sometimes we have to collect that if we're providing assistance to somebody because of income qualifications. And we normally wouldn't then turn that information over to anybody else. So if there were an interest in having us collect that because of a requirement and then turning that over, I would look for legal counsel on whether or not we should be turning it to anybody. Because we may have to retain those records because we do get on to the federal government and have to prove qualifications for that. So we're very careful about how it's kept and whether or not it's shared.
My suggestion would be let us talk that over with the department heads that are involved and get you some information back.
And we've
already had an initial conversation, and this is, since I've been here and previous we talked to everybody else, it's an isolated situation.
It was
a land transaction. It was a land transaction issue. And generally, the type of land transaction you thought it was, you're required to have that Social Security number. In this case, it was determined that it wasn't. But there was never any sort of data release. It's not something where we have like an ongoing issue. Unfortunately, the person involved really has not been happy with any answer I can give them. And I'm not sure what I'm going to say anymore. I provided all of our policies, everything that we do as a city. And we did take one of his pieces of advice about, in certain situations, this isn't across the board, but in certain situations when we do land transactions, having those documents originate from Public Works, but a portion of them are strictly returned to finance to make sure that we're not having someone's Social Security number in possibly multiple departments. So we are taking a look at doing that, but again, I mean, it is one situation, and it was a fairly unusual one at that, really. And again, nothing was ever released. It's not that Social Security number was ever viewed by someone that would not have the job responsibility to do so in that situation. So I don't think it's really a major issue. We are taking that piece of advice, so I'm taking a look at changing our policy, but you know, overall, I'm not sure what more of my response can be to the party that keeps requesting.
Well, I want to thank you for your efforts in connecting and trying, but as the council member, you know, it's been over a year, so I think the suggestion of getting together, it has to include the city attorney, however, in those discussions, because you know, Ms. Baker brought up the one thing about, you know, income levels and how private that could be or should be.
I think we can talk about it again. I do agree with Aaron, though, it is only, I've never heard of an instance of there being an issue with this before, so
okay.
We'll take a look at it.
It only goes to the finance department. It's not the only person, only department that gets or has to have those for things that they do. And there are times when the Public Works has to have them for things that they turn in on some like transaction deals that the finance department doesn't get involved with. So it's not going to be as simple as just making a simple policy that, oh, it's only the finance department that gets it because it doesn't work that way in real life.
Oh, I don't know.
This is just a real isolated incident where it got asked for because we misunderstood the type of transaction that was being done. And then it turned out
with it.
Mr. Campion?
I have limited understanding of what it is we're discussing, and we've talked about it in what has to be admittedly a pretty vague way. One concern I have is I'm not hearing what the resolution is we hope to get. And I was just wondering,
he wanted an ordinance. We're not thinking about an ordinance. But there should be some procedure to protect data privacy. Secondly, there should be a
Tennyson warning.
Tennyson
warning is a state law requirement. If I ask for private data from you, I have to tell you what it's being used for, and the consequences if you don't turn it over to me.
All right, perfect. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, you know,
we deal with that a lot.
To me, if you have those discussions with the department heads, I do.
We'll look at what's been done thus far and see if there's any other steps or if we've done all we can.
Can you communicate it as a memo? I think that'd be really
yes. Nice. And yeah. I'm not suggesting that this is not an isolated case, but if there's some type of gap that we can close by having a Tennyson warning, and also by capturing the process and what we do to protect the data, I think then we have covered our bases. Do you think that is agreeable, Mr. City Attorney?
For the city administrator to inquire and to mm-hmm. report back, yes.
But I want you to be involved as well.
I'm sure they'll let me know.
Thank you. Okay.
We talked to them an awful lot.
If you have any questions later on, let me know. And I even have an extra copy of some past correspondence if the council would like to look at it. I think everyone else might have all of the data, including the city clerk administration and the city attorney.
Okay. I have one really quick item. This comes under the category of food for thought. I sit on the Workforce Development Task Force, and Randy Johnson leads that up. And it's a number of constituent groups around the community that are working on workforce elements. And they bring those folks together. And one of the approaches that they are settling on is they don't need to reinvent the whole workforce development process, but rather perhaps create a front door, something that could be used as a resource so that someone would have a place to go and then get their workforce questions answered. The reason I mention that goes to I sat on the HRA board meeting today, and then I think Ms. Means, you made a comment during our block grant hearings last Wednesday. And I know housing is a big deal, right? And we've got a lot of housing requests out there, organizations that are out there. Certainly we know that the county is looking at passing the HRA levy. Rochester Area Foundation is looking for something related to housing. We've got a new organization, Grow Rochester. We have the rehabilitation program. We even have very select program like the Heats On and Waters Off program. And so it just occurred to me that similar to the workforce initiative and your comments, what should we be doing to make sure that we're leveraging all of those resources to the best extent possible to achieve the goals of housing? Almost all of these organizations have administrative oversight, you know, that sort of overhead that arguably doesn't go toward constructing a single building or apartment. So, again, I don't have a preconceived solution. I just wanted to get that out there as we go forward and we hear all these requests and we hear about all these dollars, are there some things we should do? And maybe this is a topic when we have our joint city-county meeting. I don't know that government can lead this, but we can hopefully contribute to that conversation. And I just wanted to get that out there as a kind of a food for thought item. Mr. Campbell.
I think that's a really good point, and it was kind of one of the things we talked about with the 2% loan program that's administered by the planning and zoning, with, you know, one of those aspects when we look at how we're allocating the block grants, I think has to be where we, you know, where, what's an initiative of the city. And we have those kind of lists there, but we can all kind of identify one of the primary causes of concern right now is the housing and facing this kind of housing crisis and what we're going to do about it. So I think those are well-timed, and it's probably really appropriate for us to revisit that as we talk about what those allocations look like and strategies for doing allocations that serve the interest immediately.
Gary, comment?
Yes, I sat on the workforce group with Randy earlier on. He's been there to date, and then Hello Grant is on there as well. One of the big projects that they're also working on is identifying who's doing what in that venue and workforce, because there's so many groups that it's hard to know who's on first, and if somebody's coming for some assistance, where do you direct them? And
sure.
I think something along the same lines in housing would be a good idea, because the city is actually one of the biggest players in housing, not just through the block grants, but how you allocate tax credits, or people apply for tax credits and using TIF. And historically, we were the partner with First Homes on all of the projects that they did. You know, they came to the table with 10,000 a unit, and the city did 10,000 a unit in TIF. So I think that gets kind of lost in the shuffle these days. But, you know, there's becoming a whole, as you said, a couple new ones just recently, housing groups in town. It would be nice to know who is doing what, and maybe there has to be a representative of each of those groups periodically getting together and seeing where they can marry things up. I know we've had discussions on a staff level and with Randy and the mayor and with the county on how maybe some of their funding can fit in with some of the projects that the council's also working on. So.
Well, they all seem to have, you know, good incentives and motivation. Some of them are very niche-oriented, and I understand that. But my concern is we've got a lot of dollars and it's such a critical need. I just want to do what we can to ensure that we're not being duplicative or, you know, misusing resources that we could better use for a very vital need. So something we can talk about going forward. That's all I have. Anyone else? Then we are adjourned. Thank you.
So Brent, can we talk to you just for a minute before you go?
Yeah.